Today in the studio, we have two of my very good friends, the professor of saxophone here at Western Michigan University, Andrew Rathbun, and our brand new professor of jazz bass, John Hebert. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, Keith. How you doing?
Hey, Keith. Thanks for having us.
I'm so happy to have you here today and happy that I actually get to play with you today. I've never played on this show before.
Me neither.
And it was only because you twisted my arm, Andrew. But I'm happy to play with.
Well, we had to have you.
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun. So speaking of that, let's start with some music. What would you like to play first?
Let's start with this really, really old tune of mine that I still enjoy playing. It's called Nine Nations, and it's from my very first record, which is called Scatter Some Stones, which coincidentally our fantastic bassist, John Hebert, was actually on that record.
Thank you. That was fun.
Yeah. It's kind of a metric workout.
So break down the tune a little bit for those of us keeping score at home.
No, don't break it down because I'm going to be counting and realize maybe it didn't come out exactly metrically accurate.
So it just starts out in this three, and then it kind of goes into four and kind of a halftime feel, and then it goes into sort of this double time kind of feeling, and then it goes back into the three. So it just keeps sort of undulating between. Yeah, there's some debate. Like, remember when we, I don't know if you remember this, but when we did it, where there's some debate. It's like, well, is that the Cournot triplet? And John was like, who cares? Let's just play the feeling and, like, don't worry about what it is. Just play the...
I don't know if I said who cares.
Well, but. But you know, it doesn't really matter at a certain point what the math is. He, you know, just the feeling of it. You know,
right. Which yeah, right. Because I don't remember counting. But well, now I know the tune. So
yeah.
But going from that three, I see it there. Dotted quarter equals quarter.
Yeah. So, anyways, the bottom line is that was a great thing about having John on. It was that he just like, well, let's just. Get it so we're in the same ballpark of the how it feels, and we'll just play the feel, which to me is more important than the math. And that's what I like about playing with John, because it always feels the moving from section to section just feels really good. He just makes those transitions really really easy
because I'm not exact.
So this tune, I wrote this tune after reading this book called The Nine Nations of North America, and it was by two journalists where they feel like North America should be nine separate countries. It should be divided up like across, you know, Canada and the United States and Mexico into these different regions based on, you know, the economy and sort of the culture and the political persuasion. And it's a really interesting book, and they have a map. It's on the front cover, and it's like, you know, the Northeast, they call it Ecotopia. You know, it's really interesting book. So that's why when I wrote this tune, I thought about these different sections, like each, I mean, obviously there's not nine sections of the tune, but these three sections could be thought of as like three little different countries kind of linked yet somewhat separate, you know? So that was the genesis behind this tune. And this is one of the, you know, simpler tunes of mine that's easier to play without a ton of rehearsal. Like, unfortunately, a lot of my music tends to be like, oh, we have to kind of really get together and go through things. You can't just hand it out and, you know, but this is one that you can basically hand out and play, you know, sight unseen.
And that was from your first record. And you said John was on the recording.
Yeah, that was from my very first record. John's on it. And the other musicians are George Colligan's on it. And this trumpet player, Taylor Haskins, and this drummer named Jeff Hirschfield. We recorded it in 97. It came out in 98. And that's kind of one of my, that was kind of one of my goals, is to do as many projects similar to that of, you know, write a book of original music, get a band, you know, record it, try and perform it, try and tour it a little bit or play it, the music a little bit. And I've been doing it ever since.
You have a lot of recordings under your name, a lot of them on the Steeplechase label. How many albums do you have?
I think like 14 or 15 at this point.
Wow.
Which means you have a lot of original music.
Yeah, I've written quite a lot of original music over the years. Almost without exception, maybe there's one or two non-originals on maybe half the records, but the rest are all original music. So that's what I really enjoy. I just really enjoy sitting down, writing something and crafting something for, you know, an ensemble, whichever that might be, who's ever in that particular group. And I think about those folks when I try and write the music. And then, you know, get together, rehearse a few times, edit, do a little bit of editing of the music, and then try and document it.
So when did you guys meet? Did you meet for that recording, or had you been playing together for a long time?
We met before that. We were playing some sessions and stuff in Brooklyn, but I don't, that's one of those things, it's long enough ago where I couldn't pinpoint the exact time or way that we met.
I'm trying to remember even the apartment you had
on Fifth Avenue.
Right, you had Brooklyn. A separate room where you were composing in, correct? Or is that your old?
Yeah, I mean, there was like a hallway that I would write in, and then we would sort of play sessions in the living room sometimes.
Yeah,
and when you say sessions, you know, for people listening that haven't lived in New York and aren't jazz musicians,
right.
And you say a session, some people think a recording session.
Yeah, so that just means people getting together to play together, work on sometimes original music, sometimes to play free, play tunes. It's sort of a mélange of all of those things. Usually in my case, I would have people over to play, and usually I'd have a somewhat of an agenda, like, okay, I have three new tunes I want to play through, you know. So we'd, you know, play a standard or two, dive into some music, work on it a little bit, maybe, you know, rehearse it, play two or three free pieces, play a standard and have lunch, you know. That that's kind of how it went. And that for me, that's culturally, you know, in New York, that was a big reason to move there, because of the pool of musicians that you could play with, the eagerness of those musicians to play these sessions. And, you know, it's a real culture in the jazz community there to do this, which I don't know. I have never seen it really replicated anywhere else, you know, especially at the level that it's at in New York. Like the folks that you can call and say, do you want to meet on Thursday at 2? It's ridiculous who will come. Like when I first moved there, I was sort of amazed that some of these folks would actually show up, and they did, and they'd play the snot out of your music, you know?
Yeah, it's a great way to meet people.
It's a great way to meet people, and it's also a great way to really up your game, because I was always calling people who were really quite a lot better than I was, and it made me improve very quickly. Like I suddenly realized, like, wow, I really have to do A, B, and C to really kind of keep up with the people around me, you know?
Yeah, it's like a workshopping ideas. You know, you get your sight reading chops together. You know, that is a huge advantage to that. And yeah, it's more, to me, it was also just, like you said, socially, it was just a hang. So you have people just getting together. Sometimes you'd play one song, but you'd be there for 3 hours just talking and maybe eating, you know, someone order a pizza or something. It was just a way to get together outside of just gigs at a club, yeah. Which maybe you wouldn't even be having that many gigs. So it's like, well, you want to play. Well, how are we going to play? Let's get together. And that's how it happens, you know. Extension of the loft scene, you know, in New York.
Explain the loft scene.
Well, I mean, I wasn't around then, but to my knowledge, you know, there were these huge lofts downtown Soho, which is now Soho, south of Houston, Broadway, also around Union Square, where these sort of factory buildings that people would build out into apartments, and they were super cheap. I mean, it wasn't what it is now, nowhere near, but you'd have a huge space. It would just be raw open space, and they would have similar thing, jam sessions where people would come over and play in these lofts. And sometimes they would be in the middle of the night. They would go all night long. And you'd actually have people coming to listen too. But maybe so-and-so would get off a gig at 2 a.m. Then they'd go hang out at Sam Rivers' pad, and people would be jamming. And they would play till 4 in the morning or 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning, go out, have breakfast. And then they'd sleep all afternoon and do it all over again. So you know, the session thing to me is sort of that, but just flipped around, because no one can play that late anymore. People have smaller apartments, so they have to do it in the afternoon because of neighbors and noise issues.
So it's hard to determine exactly where you met, but it was a session or somewhere on the scene in the jazz community. You just connected.
Something like that, yeah, I think so. I can't remember who connected us, but you know, it was, again, probably connected with a session where, I need a bass player. Oh, you should call my friend John. Like something like that, yeah. I imagine.
And I remember playing with John in New York a couple of places, and I don't remember who it was with or when the first time was we played, but I just remember this little place on the Lower East Side, like some kind of coffee shop or something. I can't remember who it was, maybe a guitar player or something.
Cabejas?
I can't remember what
was it
was.
That place?
You know, it's just funny. You just you're in this big community, and then
yeah, and also enough time goes by, and you start to lose the finer points of some of the details about those things. You know, you're struggling just to get through this week, and you can't remember 5 years ago what, you know, how it exactly went down.
If this was '97, you're saying recorded, so I graduated from college in like 95. So that's when I kind of first moved into the city, into the 95, city, yeah. 96. So it wasn't shortly after that I actually moved that we were.
Right.
I mean, I was doing some sessions before that, driving in from Jersey when I was in school. But, you know, that sounds, I don't know when you moved to Brooklyn though.
97.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew, you've played with a long list of important jazz musicians, and you've studied with some of the great teachers as well, including Billy Hart, and you've certainly performed a lot with your friend Luciana Souza and your teacher George Garzon, who I think we're going to talk about later, I hope. But Kenny Wheeler, the great trumpeter and composer, how did you meet Kenny? And I know you've had a long relationship with him, and tell us about that.
So I met Ken at the Banff Center for the Arts, which has an incredible summer workshop every year. It's sort of started by Dave Holland, so I think that's how Kenny got associated with it. He started bringing Ken over to be on the faculty. And then a great Canadian musician by the name of Hugh Fraser took it over, and him and Ken were really, really tight, so he kept having Ken come back. So I met him there. And that was the first time I got the chance to play with him. And I went back the next summer. I went like two summers concurrent, like in a row. And the second summer, I wrote like a four-horn suite for Ken. This trombone player was running it, Hugh Fraser, myself playing soprano saxophone, and a great tenor player named Pat LaBarber playing tenor saxophone. So it was like four horns and rhythm section. And so that was the first time we sort of really like played together, like where I was standing beside him and like standing beside that sound. And then subsequent to that, there were some Canadian musicians who were using him on some projects, which I was really fortunate to be a part of. And we just kind of hit it off. And when I moved to New York, I said, you know, would you like to come and do some of your big band music? So I organized some concerts of his big band music at this club called Birdland, which John did the first time or the second time. We did it a couple times. Yeah. So then we did a little quintet tour and whatnot. And so at that point, I got up the courage to like ask him, like, would you come over to do a record? And he's like, yeah, sure. So at that time, I was recording for this label called Fresh Sound. And at that time, you know, there was actually like budgets and, you know, you could get airline tickets and, you know, more than 6 hours of studio time and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So Jordi Pujol of Fresh Sound thought it was a cool idea. And so we recorded that in September of 2011, maybe 3 weeks after September 11th. It was like very late. It was late in the month. And when September 11th happened, I thought, that's it. It's not going to happen. But Ken was like, yeah, I'd like to still come. And he was really gracious, and him and his wife flew over, and we did 2 days at this little studio on Green Street called The Studio, which I sort of always sort of had a soft spot for, that place. And we did this record called Sculptures together. And I wrote a book of music that I tried to... you know, make him feel really comfortable. I didn't try and give him anything that was sort of out of his wheelhouse and his strike zone. And he wrote me a couple months after that saying he really enjoyed it. And, you know, sometimes he feels like he felt like he was like miscast in a way, like people were calling him to do records that he didn't feel like, why did you ask me to do this? You should have asked someone else. I don't really do what you're asking me to do well. But, you know, I tried to avoid that problem. So, yeah, it's one of my favorite records I've ever done, just because he's on it, and it's a great rhythm section. John's on it, and this pianist named Frank Carlberg, who ended up having an association with Ken after that as well because of that record, and Jeff Hirschfield, the drummer's on it as well. And, I like that record. So, yeah, why don't we play one of Ken's pieces? Ken's not only known as a great trumpet player, but as a, you know, in my mind, one of the greatest jazz composers. He has a huge list of tunes. He's just a phenomenal composer, someone who's, you know, obviously really influenced me a ton. And so we're going to play one of his pieces called On Mo. Ken is sort of known for these really bad puns, and this is one of them. On Mo is short for one more. So I, you know, when I said, Ken, what this tune is so beautiful, what's it about? And oh, it's just one more, you know, like it's another tune, you know, that he just wrote one morning. He had a very disciplined writing routine where he, you know, would wake up early in the morning, have a cup of tea, play through some Bach chorales, listen to some Hindemith, and then sit down at the piano and start writing. So this is just one of the tunes that he wrote, you know, one more.
Thank you.
Thank you.